This is making me very angry because here comes the colonel. Here comes the colonel.
Oh, yeah, the comedians are still at it, sneaking in here, causing all the problems from the auditions for Comedy Central down the hall. All right. Well, let's get serious here. Welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. In just a minute, we're going to get back to this segment's guest with Jack Bishop. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments of the Voice of Reason. But right now, let's step over here to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set and summon up the spirit of the fountain by digging around in the coin jar here just a little bit and pull today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Yes, I see we have awakened the spirit of the fountain by throwing in the coins. The spirit who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for price. All right. Oh, spirit of the fountain, here's one for you. What Japanese island had U.S. military bases occupying one-fifth of its total land area in 2000? The year 2000, what Japanese island, the United States military still had bases occupying one-fifth of its total land areas.
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the other.
Oh, yes, the Spirit of the Fountain knows. This was really kind of an easy one for the old Spirit of the Fountain, I bet. The Japanese island that had U.S. military bases occupying one-fifth of its total land area in the year 2000? That island was Okinawa, of course. Okinawa. All right. Back to Jack Bishop in our program.
Science News Network, Jack Bishop here. Dr. Patrick Ingbertson with us. He is the author of the book, The Basics of Hacking and Penetration, in its second edition. And, Doctor, before we took the break that we just came back from, I mentioned that you have a whole chapter on what you call scanning. Now, I've got to admit that the word rings no bell, for me at least.
Yeah, so let me walk you through that a little bit. So in the last segment, we talked briefly about the idea of reconnaissance. And so if I just step back to that for a second, the idea of one of the ideas of reconnaissance, and there's a lot of goals there, but one of the ideas is, Let me give you an example. If an organization wants to be tested, but they don't give you any information about themselves, right? Or if an attacker is going to go after a company or an organization, or let's just say for clarity's sake, let's say somebody walks up to you on a street and hands you a napkin, and on the napkin is written the name of a company, just Acme, right? And there's no other information about it. You don't know anything about that organization. You don't know where they're located, how many employees they have, what kind of technology they've used, what kind of defenses they have in place. So you don't know any of that information. How do you go from just this napkin with a name on a napkin all the way to bypassing all of those technical defenses and getting into the organization? How does an attacker do that? And then once we learn those steps, can we stop that process? What can we do to prevent that from happening? And so recon is really about translating that name on the napkin into something that we can actually begin to run tools on, right? So we can actually get things like, what are the IP addresses? Are they running web servers? Are they running DNS or other types of external facing things? Do they have email? All of that type of stuff. Once we have that done and we have these actual identifiable targets on the systems or the systems that we want to go after, we move into scanning. And scanning is really saying, okay, I have a website, which is a URL, or I have an IP address, which is the server that they have running that hosts their email. Once I have that, scanning is really about actually going to use an analogy, scanning the system. If you think of the system as a house, scanning is really going up and knocking on the windows and pushing on the doors and checking the locks and just looking to see what's open, what's running, what kind of system is it, what operating system is it running, does it have other services that it's actually serving up to the internet, and how can a person gain access to that system. So scanning is really about taking the information from reconnaissance and then translating that into some type of useful information for the either attacker or, in this case, the penetration tester.
You know, I was thinking it's kind of like, the burglar trying to get into your home. He's going to check the locks and, you know, check the doors first, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And scanning gets very detailed as well. If we kind of continue that analogy, scanning can be very similar to the process of the burglar saying, okay, now I'm really going to go and inspect the house. I'm going to see if there's an alarm system, and I'm going to check those windows, and then I'm going to look at the locks. This is not the point where the burglar is kicking in the door, but again, this may be the point where the burglar is checking to see what is the make of the lock, and do I know how to pick that lock? And you're really verifying the information that you found in that initial reconnaissance phase.
The chapter of your book that will probably get most people's attention if they look in the table of contents, the one that will probably get their attention right away, is the chapter titled Exploitation.
Absolutely. Yeah, so this is the chapter that I think most people associate with traditional quote-unquote hacking. Exploitation is really the process of gaining access to that system. So again, if we go back and we kind of continue our model or our methodology, exploitation is the one. This is one of the things I found. One of the reasons why I wrote the book. A lot of people, especially the students that I was interacting with, they had heard about something or some tool or some process that they could run and exploit and do something on the system, add a user or create a backdoor or do something on that system. But they didn't know anything about the steps that came before it or after it. They just knew if they kind of pushed a button here, then they would get access to this machine. And so exploitation is the actual act, again, that most people are going to associate with hacking, although hacking in general, right, without any of those previous steps, doesn't really get you a lot and doesn't really provide any value to a potential client if you're doing a security assessment. And so even though it's the one that grabs the most attention, and it certainly is a very important step, it probably in most cases, at least in my experience, in most cases, it is actually among the fastest and shortest steps as well. If you do your homework in the early stages in reconnaissance and scanning, when it comes time for exploitation, that's typically a very short phase or a very short window. We understand the target fully. We understand the processes that are running on the system, and then we can somehow compromise that system. So, it's definitely the phase that gets the most attention when it comes to, and the phase typically that people are most interested in. So people, usually what I see is people get interested or excited in that process to start with, and then they realize, that they're missing a lot of knowledge, and so they have to kind of backfill with the other steps and phases.
Another chapter in your book, by the way, let me remind them of the title, The Basics of Hacking and Penetration, is the chapter entitled Social Engineering. Now, most of us, once again, that rings some sort of alarm bell that we're not really able to pinpoint. So when we start talking about the computer world and the internet and all of that, what is social engineering in that case?
Yeah, so another excellent question, and something that this is really important for people to understand. Social engineering is essentially bypassing the ideas of, we have very detailed rules on our firewalls, and we have all the latest tools and techniques and technology in place to prevent, technological steps and defenses to prevent attackers from gaining access to our systems. Social engineering is the idea that we're going to try to exploit the human side of our systems, right? So in this case, if I can't get access to a system, one thing I might be able to do is I might be able to call your organization or call your company and pretend to be somebody. My name is Pat, and I work for your ISP, your internet service provider, and I see, just letting you know that we have a maintenance window coming up, and I just need to verify with you some information. And the idea or the goal here is that I can bypass all those technology defenses you have in place and get the human to give me the answers I need. And in most cases, it's a very, very effective type of attack, and it's one that in recent years has become increasingly popular and increasingly sophisticated, and as a result, increasingly more successful. And so, yeah, the listeners definitely want to be aware of this. You know, I think the idea many people have in their head goes back to the traditional, whether it was a Nigerian bank scam or bank fraud, and a lot of those old phishing emails were very easy to spot. They used terrible broken English, and you know, or kind of the example that always comes to mind is somebody won the Spanish lottery even though they never played the Spanish lottery. And so, you know, it wasn't that hard to spot. But today's social engineers are very, very clever, and they're very difficult in many cases to detect. And so you always want to be on your guard.
Just keep a watchful eye.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Always be suspicious. Yep.
Now, when we think in terms of what you just said, the first thing that came to mind, for me at least, was in the novel where they're doing the bank heist and there's a phone call made to somebody, and the plot thickens from that point on. Now, that leads me to this question. While we've pretty much looked at this question of security from a personal standpoint, the really big problem, if I read you right, is in the business world.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of the information and people that I work with, and a lot of the people that are really taking notice or feeling the pain of this is in the corporate world, and it's very difficult in a large organization and even in a small organization, you know, to keep track of this. We try to be very customer service oriented in our business. We try to make sure that the customer feels good. We don't offend them. And so those types of tendencies that humans and organizational cultures have, those feed directly into a social engineer's attacking style. So, you know, a person that can go in or a person that can impersonate somebody or act as somebody else can be very, very effective.
The entity that probably has the best security has to be the federal government, right?
Yes.
Yet, how did all of the information that recently came out about the NSA, how did that get out into the public sphere?
Yeah, so I know, you know, personally, I'm not an expert in the area, but I mean, that was a data leakage case, as far as everything I've read, that said essentially, you know, some people had shared some passwords and broken some policies, and Snowden was able to copy some information and take it out on some type of removable media. So yeah, it's just another case of, you know, data leakage, as with many of the styles and the types of attacks out there, are something everybody needs to be concerned of, whether it's a federal government or an individual or a corporation.
Goes back to what you said about social engineering. Somebody said the wrong thing to the wrong person, or maybe the right person, and the information that the government wanted secret was no longer secret.
Yep, exactly. And that's not an uncommon thing. It happens a lot. Data leakage itself is a very big style of attack where you know, something gets out.
Now, you made the transition at one point in your career from the college campus to the business world and to the federal and to the government world. Now, I would imagine that there is a tremendous industry in protecting our data, with a lot of opportunities for young college students who are looking around for something to do after mom and dad get tired of picking up the tab.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is an amazing landscape or field for a person to be in right now. We have students at the university here who are, you know, 19 and 20 years old, and they're coming out, and we have 100% placement in our programs.
100% placement?
100%, yeah, and I don't think that's unique just to our college. I mean, I can't speak for other schools, but, yeah, 100%. And we have young students coming through, and we have people that are coming through to retrain and retool their skill set because of the opportunities that are out there.
My goodness, 100% placement. Now, when you're looking for a job, say, in data security,
yep,
you just can't be some kid who's handy with a computer, right?
No, you know, you really can't anymore. I think there was that a time and a place for that when we didn't really have the training and the education available for students. So I think that is true. I think it helps if you're handy with a computer, if you have a passion for it, because it like many other jobs, it requires long days and long nights and a lot of time on the edge of your seat. And so you, as you do with every career, I think if you have a passion and a drive for it, I think you can be very successful. I would definitely say.
By the way, we're spending some time here on the Science News Network talking with Dr. Patrick Engelbertson and his new book, which is entitled The Basics of Hacking and Ethical Penetration. He's a professor, by the way. Don't think we mentioned this. He's a professor of information assurance at Dakota State University. And he was, before we got started, telling us how much snow they had up there. So we've got to
we're getting some cold weather this week, so
we got to get
a
you
white
down.
Christmas for us.
We got to get you down here to Texas, warm you up a little bit.
I would take an opportunity to do that.
You know, whenever we start talking about the internet, there are so many myths that pop up, so many misconceptions, so many out and out untruths that it amazes me. As we said earlier, how much people put faith in putting out their information on the net and talking about their everyday life. And you, in your book, you talk about web-based exploitation. And I think we kind of covered that, but I think it's worth going back over again some of the things that you said we could do. One, not put everything out there. Whether it's as an individual or as a corporation or as an organization. But are there other simple steps that we could take?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one of the things that gets people is that, you know, we tend to focus a lot of time and energy and effort in our defensive security, which we should be doing. But the problem, I think, a lot of people end up throwing their hands up on occasion is because some of the new styles of attack, when we're talking about especially web-based attacks, these attacks often are conducted against services which have to run or have to be on the internet in order for them to work.
So, what kind of services are you talking about?
Yeah, so things like let me give you a couple examples, like an email server, for example. I'm famous for saying in my classes, you can't block what you have to let in. Meaning, if you want to get email into your organization, you have to accept email. So you have to have an email server or an email service processing that email. If you put a web page out there, in most cases, you probably want to generate website traffic. Meaning, you need to allow people to browse that web page. And so when we have these services that, I mean, their whole goal, their whole job is to actually allow and create these connections. That's what they're out there for. It makes it difficult to defend those type of attacks. And so web is oftentimes the new front door of these attacks, because, you know, we put these processes and these services, email and web and all of that, we put all of those things out there. And I think it gets a little deeper than that as well. If you look back, if you remember kind of the earlier days of the internet, a colleague of mine explains this very well, and he says, you know, if you went to ESPN, it was just kind of a static ESPN web page. They gave you some sports scores, and that was it. And today, if you go to ESPN, you can log in and then you get your customized sports scores and you get your latest updates and you get all the things, and it's really a dynamic website. Well, it's dynamic because of the way that the code is written and the back-end systems that allow the ESPN or the company to do those type of things, which means that our systems are much more complex and they hold a lot more information, a lot more data, and as a result of that, there's just more attack vectors available to the attackers.
The next chapter in your book is post-exploitation and maintaining access with backdoors, rootkits, and other such things as that. Big problem?
Yeah, so it is. It definitely is. I think this is one chapter that I really spent a lot of time in the second edition retooling because I just found I had a lot of questions from readers, which I'm always happy to interact with readers about this type of process. And so post-exploitation really gets down to the idea that our previous step, which is exploitation, is a very fast, that's the traditional hacking model or hacking tools or hacking techniques that we talked about earlier. You get access to a system or compromise a system. That's a pretty quick, typically, that's a pretty quick process. And one of the things that the attacker or the penetration tester wants to do is stabilize that and be able to come back. So I think it's pretty clear now that the attackers, a true attackers, by and large, and this is a kind of cutting a wide swath here, but by and large, attackers are much more today into the long-term infiltration of systems and networks. And previously, you know, pre-2010, 2009, before those years, there was a lot more of the what I would call smash-and-grab type of attacks where people would hit a website or hit a service or hit a company and get the data, dump the data, and then get out. And it seems that if you look at a lot of the incident response reports that are out there, today it seems that there's a lot more long-term infiltration where people are getting access into systems, attackers are getting access into systems, and then they're staying and they're exfiltrating or pushing that data out of the network. And so the idea and the goal in this chapter of the book was really to try to introduce that concept to people so that they can begin to learn how the attackers are doing that, and they can check for themselves if they're a victim to any of those type of attacks.
So you check, see if you're a victim, you take the steps to correct it, and you may need to take the steps to perhaps ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really the whole goal or one of the main tenets of the book is, and again, this is just the basics of it, so just kind of getting your feet wet, but, you know, take a look at these tools and these techniques that people are using and the process that people are using, and once you've done that, and you check that against your own organization, you can go back and start fixing those holes that you found or those issues that you found so that you know, when a real attacker comes along, they're not... they're not successful.
Now, is that the last chapter of your book wrapping up the penetration test?
It is, yeah. So the last chapter is just kind of an overview, and the idea there was really I wanted to send the reader off with, okay, now at this point you probably have a decent level of fundamental knowledge. Everybody's kind of on the same playing field. And there are a lot of great authors. There's a lot of great books that are out there. And there's a lot of great websites and tutorials and trainings that you can go take and education that you can get. And at this point, with that kind of basic knowledge in the back of your pocket and a good idea of how the whole system works together, you can really start diving into some of those subsets inside of, penetration testing or ethical hacking that might interest you. So maybe somebody wants to know more about exploitation, or maybe somebody wants to know more about, information gathering or reconnaissance. And so you can really kind of start specializing then in those books in the security stores or in the bookstores, in the security section, they don't look as intimidating now, and you're able to get a lot more out of them. And then it talks a little bit, about one of the things that's most important if you're going to do ethical hacking or penetration testing is writing the report. So writing the report, you've done this assessment, you've done an ethical hack or a penetration test against an organization, The report really is the value to the organization that you did it. So this is where you detail in very clear language, you know, what did you do and how did you do it and what can they do to fix it. So three very, very important kind of steps in there. And everybody has their own style and kind of idea of how to write a report, but the point there is not to get into the details of how to write the report, just that you provide that value back to those people that have paid you to do the assessment.
Dr. Patrick Ingbertson, he is the author of the book, The Basics of Hacking and Penetration, Ethical Hacking. And in our office here at Science News Network, almost every one of us says we've got a book in us. And I always like to ask the author of a book that we have on the show, what was the toughest thing in writing this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there was two things that were really difficult for me. Like you said, this is something for me that was always an interest area that I had. And so the first thing was just knowing where to start. It seems like, you know, if you walk into a bookstore, whether it's a local bookstore or a big national chain, and you see all those books, it seems so far to go from your head to the shelf that sometimes that seems a bit intimidating. And so knowing where to turn to and how to start, in my particular case, I actually started by basically calling these, I was reading a lot of books, and I still do. I read a lot of security books, and so I knew the popular publishers, and I started making phone calls to them saying, I have this idea for a book, you know, are you interested? And one of the publishers actually said, if you want to write a book, why don't you start by doing proposal reviews? We have a lot of people propose books, you know, 4 to 10 page proposals in your area, subject area. Why don't you, you know, do some reviews for us? So I did those reviews, and then I got an idea for what I thought was successful and what was not, and I had been building my material, kind of keeping notes and in my head, and eventually I got around to writing my own proposal and putting it out there, and it got picked up, and it got approved, and so that was kind of the getting the started was the hardest part. Was one of the hardest parts, and I think the other thing was the long hours it took. And I put myself on a very tight time frame, and that's because a lot of the stuff in a technical book is very time sensitive. So the publishing process, you know, even if you try to condense it as short as possible, for me the shortest term I could get it done in was about a year, a little less than a calendar year. Well, from a technical standpoint, a lot of things can change in a year, so I really had to push a lot of nights and weekends, take time away from my family in order to get it done. And so that was a difficult task as well. But you know, in the end, very worth it, and I was very, very happy with the work.
Did you ever reach a point where you said to yourself, "I just can't go on"?
Yeah, I actually did. I came home one night, and I had just finished my dissertation at the time and was teaching a full load, and then my wife and I had just had a daughter, our second daughter, and I actually came home to her and I said, I can't do it anymore. I can't. It's too much. It's too much work. I'm missing too much time with the family, and I'm too stressed out. And I said, I'm gonna call him and tell him, you know, I'm out. I'm not gonna do it. You know, and God bless her. She literally sat me down and said, you know what, you can do this. And we got it covered here at home for you, and this is something you've always wanted to do, and you're very close to the finish line, more close than you realize. You know, I know there's still a lot of words to write, but to be that ultimate encourager for me was the only thing that kept me in the game at the time, and gave me the strength I needed to finish up and push through those last few months and get the book off to the publisher.
What a wonderful part of your story there that, you know, once again, we see the importance of having support in the things we do. Now, I've got to ask you this before we go. When you had the book published and you got the first copy of it in your hand, what did you say to yourself?
Yeah, so that's a it's an amazing feeling. So I've done some really wonderful things that I'm proud of in my life, you know, and I have to say that it ranks right up there, if not even above the earning my doctorate. The UPS guy, I didn't really realize that it was ready. You kind of finish writing. I believe I finished writing in about February, and you send it off, and you have some electronic edits back and forth, and you don't really hear anymore from them. And being a first-time author, I didn't know, you know, I didn't want to be too aggressive with the publisher, so I didn't poke or prod them. And one day in about June or late June or early July, the UPS man showed up at the door, and we were all kind of standing outside, and he brought this brown box out, and I signed for it, and I didn't know what it was. We opened it up, and it was a stack of my books that they had finished pre-publishing and printing on, and I hadn't seen the cover or anything up until that point, so it was really quite a moment for my family and I. We were all pretty excited.
One of those eureka moments that comes in life when you are diligent and you press hard with your dreams. Doctor, we want to thank you so much for being with us. By the way, we didn't mention, who is the publisher?
Yeah, so the publisher is Syngress, and they do a number of technical books. Very, very good to work with.
Our guest, Dr. Patrick Ingbritson, author of the book The Basics of Hacking and Penetration, Ethical Hacking and Penetration Testing Made Easy. Didn't sound too easy to me. Doctor, I appreciate you being with us on the Science News Network.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but you got to be careful who you trust, right? You know, I ran across this little saying of a little cartoon, a dog sitting in front of a computer says, on the internet, no one knows that you're really a dog. You have to be aware of what you're doing. This is Professor Larry Snyder. I'm the director of the Masters in Cybersecurity Management at Baypath College in Longmeadow, Massachusetts.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.